Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, very happy new year to you. I'm Cy Killett, your host. Been away for a couple days recovering from a touch of the flu, and so I haven't gotten to wish you a happy new year. I hope you're happy. Your new year is going well and is happy. Jimmy Akins, our guest today, and it is open forum. Open forum meaning any question you've got on the Catholic Church, on Catholic history or morals, or if you have a question of a religious or philosophical or moral nature, we're happy to take those. You don't have to be Catholic to call. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you, Cy?
I am very well now. Very well now and very good. Happy. I get 2 hours with you
likewise.
To start my new year. And you know, today is the very last day for Catholic Answers to be a teenager.
That's right.
Catholic Answers Live, I mean.
Tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of the show.
Right. We're going to do the big 20th anniversary show. Surprise guests. I'm told there may be streamers. It's going to be – which makes great radio. Mm-hmm. Streamers really make for some great radio. So how long have you been at it out of these 20 years?
20. I was on show number one.
You were
in fact, I'm the only person still on staff who was on show number one.
Really?
Yeah.
Who else was on? Was there another? Well, first of all, it was only 1 hour at that
Correct.
Time, right? You started doing a 1 hour show.
Mm-hmm. And going to 2 hours was my suggestion, incidentally.
And nicely done, Jimmy.
Thank you.
It's a good suggestion. Could you suggest 3 hours?
I have suggested.
Have you?
Yeah.
We could do another hour. What's up, Darren? Okay, Darren says, yeah. Okay, it's now a three-hour show. Somebody tell EWTN, will you, that it's now a three-hour show?
We may need to
It needs more deliberation than that?
Yeah.
Okay. So you were on the first show, and when you first started 20 years ago, was it all open forum? Did you
no.
do theme shows?
Did you? We didn't have open forum yet. It wasn't yet invented.
Uh-huh.
We did invent it fairly quickly, but at the beginning, you know, there wasn't always confidence that we would be able to have the breadth of knowledge needed to be able to do an open forum on just unrestricted topics. And some of the topics we originally had planned were like way too narrow. I remember that you could never get a productive hour of radio out of them. Like I remember one of the early shows we had scheduled was an entire hour, believe it or not, on the question of who can go to communion.
Oh, that is
and I think that
was on a fun Friday. Or?
I think that was the show that when we actually got up to the time to do that show is like, this is never going to work, and I think that may have become the first open forum.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, it takes time to learn how to do this, and Catholic Answers started when nobody was doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there really weren't Catholic. Were you? But you were very familiar with Protestant.
Oh yeah,
radio.
I was a jock on a country station when I was in high school.
Yeah, yeah. Protestant radio shows tended not to be an hour, though.
That's true. A lot of Protestant radio shows, and I would listen after I became a Christian. I'd listen to a lot of Protestant radio, but they're frequently much shorter. Some of them on little bitty stations like the ones I listened to in Arkansas, they could be as short as 15 minutes or something. But most of them seem to be like 30 minutes. Few of them hour long, but a lot of them were 30 minutes at the time. I'm not sure what it is these days, but you'd have a lot of like TV shows based on the preaching ministry of a particular preacher. And 30 minutes is a reasonable amount of preaching time to build a show around.
Right.
But an hour is a little more challenging. And so there were a lot of 30-minute shows.
888-318-7884, our number, 888-31-TRUTH, if you prefer it that way. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Catholic Answers, last day as a teenager. Tomorrow the show turns 20. and all kinds of interesting, some surprise guests on tomorrow. Jimmy will be here again with us. Sorry to make you work before in front of the microphone 2 days in a row. Jimmy, you going to be all right?
I like radio.
I know
it'll be
you
fine.
Do. I know you do. Chris Check hosted yesterday while I was out.
And
he left a cup of tea for me, but it was cold by the time I got to it. I probably shouldn't.
Dang. Second law of thermodynamics.
I know. I am so tired of thermodynamics. I can't tell you. I just feel like I'm just melting to a state of entropy.
I don't know. I heard him summarized, like the three laws of thermodynamics once summarized is you can't – how did it go? I'm not sure I can remember all three, but it's like you can't win, you can't break even, and you can't leave the game.
Very much like Las Vegas for some people.
Yeah.
Again, 888-318-7884. We have time before we have to take a break. So let's go to Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Ryan, thanks so much for calling. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
All right. My question is, given the Western rite of the church has different variations of the Mass, such as the Ambrosian rite, the Mozarabic rite, the Anglican use, the Dominican rite, and et cetera, would it be possible for the Vatican to resurrect or bring back rites or uses of Mass that they haven't used in a long time, such as the Celtic rite, the Durham rite, the Uppsala use, the use of York, and so on, if people had enough interest in doing so?
Hypothetically, it's possible. I don't foresee it happening except in cases of where you have a group of people who have been outside of the Catholic Church, who are coming back into union and want to retain elements of their prior heritage. And for most of those groups, you don't currently have groups of people outside of the church who are continuing to use most of those liturgical traditions. The other way that you could have something like that happen is during periods of liturgical renewal, you in particular, or at the initiative of local bishops' conferences, you could have texts that are based on some older texts that the bishops want to retrieve these traditions and include them, but it wouldn't be a full resurrection of these older liturgical forms. It would just incorporate elements of them. We saw something like that happen after Vatican II, where there was a desire on the part of the council to retrieve some older liturgical forms that had been used in the church in previous centuries in different parts of the Christian world. And they ended up getting incorporated into the Mass in various ways. We got out of that, among other things, the exchange of the sign of peace, which is something that had not been part of the Western Rite previously. Also, we got things like the second through the fourth Eucharistic prayers contain elements from prior or other rite sources. But I don't foresee a bunch of people petitioning Rome. It could happen, but I don't foresee any likely scenario where a bunch of people say, hey, let's all start celebrating the Mass exactly the way it was celebrated by Celts in the 7th century and Rome saying, yeah, okay. I can imagine scenarios where you have elements from that liturgical tradition being retrieved, but a full resurrection of the Mass of that time, given the fact you don't have anybody celebrating it that way today at all outside of the church, doesn't create a plausible scenario for it coming back in its fullness.
Okay, Ryan?
Yeah, that helps nicely. Can I add just one other thing real fast?
Sure.
Okay, I'm curious. When I attended Youth 2000 last year, a seminarian friend of mine told me that the sacramentary is not supposed to be used to celebrate Mass anymore unless it's an emergency. If his understanding about this is correct, does that mean the only time the old Mass translation before 2011 can only be used again if it's an emergency, if the current Missal translation is just not available for some reason?
Oh, I see what you mean. So by this, when you refer to the sacramentary, you're referring to an edition of what's now commonly called the Roman Missal. It had a different translation prior in English prior to 2010. And yeah, the pre-2010 translation is not to be used under ordinary circumstances. We're supposed to use the currently authorized translation.
Ryan, thank you very much for that call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we'll be right back with more right after this.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live.
January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's DVD, Making the Case for Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of over 70%. This DVD was made specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue, and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together, we might build up a pro-life culture. One person, one conversation at a time. To get your copy of the DVD, Making the Case for Life, for just $5 a copy, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible? Or did Protestants remove 7 books from the Old Testament? Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information and discourse on crucial issues, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. And as a special bonus, if you order online, we'll add an ebook copy of 15 Myths, Mistakes, and Misrepresentations About the Deuterocanon to your order absolutely free. Get your free ebook today. Order your copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger by logging on to our online shop at shop.catholic.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. And at $3 a copy when purchased in bulk, it's perfect for parish distribution and any of your adult faith formation needs. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett. Your host, Jimmy Akin, is our guest. And the topic is up to you because we will take any question of a religious, moral, ethical nature, or anything having to do with the Catholic Church. If you're not Catholic, we'd love it if you call. If you are Catholic, we'd also love it if you call 888-318-7884. Let's go to Brian in Peoria, Arizona. Brian, thanks for calling. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Jimmy, I had a question regarding the sin of the high hand that
okay.
It talks about in Numbers 11, 30, and 31,
mm-hmm.
and also about confession, mm-hmm. as it's talked about in Numbers 5, I believe it's 6 and 7.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have any relation to how the church looks at mortal sin and confession now?
It doesn't have a direct relation. For people who may not be aware, the Old Testament discusses sinning with a high hand. And what that really means is a deliberate, conscious knowing, this is a sin and I'm just doing it anyway. That's what sinning with a high hand is, as opposed to sinning inadvertently or, committing in the Old Testament. You could commit a ritual infraction without even being aware that, you know, you had done it. And so because there's a difference in the level of deliberation that's involved in these different sins, it's natural for them to be treated in different ways. Obviously, the more deliberately you sin, the worse it is, as opposed to, you know, if you do something without even realizing it, even though it's objectively bad, or if you did it under like the compulsion of strong feelings or something, it's not as bad as if you just knowingly and deliberately say, this is evil and I'm going to do it anyway. And so in the Old Testament, what it says is that basically, if you sin with a high hand, you're going to get punished for it. It says God won't forgive you. But what that means in the Old Testament context is you're just going to have to experience some consequences. In the Old Testament, they didn't have the same orientation towards forgiveness and eternal life that we do. They didn't you do have references to a life after death in the Old Testament, and late in the Old Testament, you even have references to the resurrection of the dead. But at this early stage in the Pentateuch, where this is being talked about, the overwhelming focus is on this life. And when the Hebrews in this era thought about being forgiven, they understood that not to mean forgiven so I go to heaven. They understood that to mean forgiven so I won't get punished in this life. And so when it says God's not going to forgive people who sin with the high hand, it doesn't mean they're going to hell. It means they're going to experience some consequences in this life for their deliberate act of, and defiant act of sin. Does that have a relationship to mortal sin and to confession? Well, in an indirect way, obviously. Deliberate consent is one of the conditions that's required for mortal sin today, as we would articulate it. And so you could say a sin with a high hand is one that is the equivalent of a mortal sin. Because we have a broader focus now where we're not just concerned about what's going to happen in this life, we are concerned about what's going to – principally as Christians, we're concerned in terms of forgiveness of what's going to happen in the next life. We wouldn't say that God's not going to forgive anybody just because they've committed a mortal sin. God absolutely will forgive people who've committed a mortal sin. That's something that is in fact one of the principal purposes of the sacrament of confession. It's something the church has always understood. It's something the church has infallibly taught. And so you may experience some consequences as a result of knowingly and deliberately committing a mortal sin. Yeah, there may be some consequences in this life. God may allow you to experience some so that you learn your lesson. But it's not that's not where our ultimate focus is. He will forgive you and he will allow you to be with him in heaven afterwards. Also, we're living in an age of mercy in a way that wasn't necessarily the case in the Old Testament. I mean, God did show mercy, but not in the same way as in the age of mercy that was inaugurated by the coming of his son. And so even today, we're going to be a little more circumspect about how much consequences you may experience from a mortal sin. We won't say there's going to be none when you repent and are forgiven of the mortal sin, but also we're not going to insist and say, oh yeah, you definitely will have consequences too. We leave that up to God. So we're more a little more cautious about how we would express that today and leave more room for God's discretion and mercy.
Thank you, Brian, for that call. 888-318-7884, our number, open forum today, both hours. Any question you have on the Catholic faith, we'd be happy to take it. We go now to Gil in Manhattan, New York. Hi, Gil. You are on with Jimmy Akin.
Good evening, Jimmy Akin. I hope you remember me. This is a blind caller that I used to call.
I remember you, Gil.
Oh, praise the Lord. And I remember you on the Bible Answer Man, Hank Hanegraaff program.
Uh-huh. What can I do for you today?
In Hebrews 13:8, the Bible says Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Mm-hmm. And in Matthew 26, it says, take this, all of you, and drink from it. This is my body, which will be given up for you. Now, in light of that, how come, since Jesus Christ is the same, we can't get healing today from, let's say, the body of Christ? Well, receiving the Eucharist, in other words.
We can.
Because I have suffered from blindness and I'm losing my hearing, too.
Well, I'm
so
sorry
it's getting
to hear
harder
that.
For me.
I'm sorry to hear that, and I'd encourage folks to pray for you. We can receive healing through receiving the Eucharist. We can be physically healed in that way. We can certainly pray that Jesus heal us when we receive communion. He hasn't promised to do so. And so we can't count on it happening, but we can certainly ask, and he may choose to do it. We can also show by experience that it seems not to be his will to heal with in a miraculous way with necessarily the same frequency that he did in his personal ministry. And we can speculate about why that is. We do have good evidence that miraculous healings still occur today, but not necessarily with the same frequency as they did when Jesus was wandering the countryside conducting a healing ministry. But we certainly have the ability to ask him to heal us when we receive the Eucharist, and we also have the sacrament of the anointing of the sick whenever we have a serious health issue, as another sacrament that he's given us, which does have a specific orientation towards healing. And if it's his will and if it would help us with our salvation, then he can and will heal us through it. But we also have to recognize that it's not always his will to heal us. That's something that St. Paul recognized in his own life. St. Paul had various illnesses. He talks to St. Timothy about some frequent stomach ailments that St. Timothy had. And so right there in the apostolic age, it wasn't always God's will for us to experience healing, but sometimes it is, and we can praise him when that happens.
Yes.
Okay.
And you would also say that suffering in our lives is also meant to reflect the glory of God. Like Paul says in Romans 5:3, that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint us.
Plays a role in spiritual development.
Gil, thanks very, very much for that call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live, and I think we have time to get to another call before we have to take another break. So let's go to Mike in Iowa, listening on 102.7 FM Spirit Catholic Radio. Mike, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, this is Mike. I love listening to your program, and I have an urge to try and convert people to the Catholic faith. So my question is, one of my coworkers stated today that some of the greatest theologians in their mind was St. Thomas Aquinas, mm-hmm. Luther, and Jonathan Edwards. How would you respond to that?
I'd say that obviously they each had strong theological minds that allowed them to make a reputation for themselves as theologians that's lasted centuries. That doesn't mean they're right about everything, but we can certainly acknowledge the gifts that they had that enabled them to generate such reputations that have lasted this long. So I'd be inclined to find common ground in that way. I would, if I'm trying to encourage someone to consider the Catholic faith, rather than beating up on Luther or Edwards, I would say, here's something about the Catholic faith that I find really interesting and that I think you might find interesting too. Here's an issue or some arguments related to an issue that I find particularly compelling, and I thought I'd bring them to your attention.
What do you think of that, Mike?
That sounds like a good approach, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mike. It does seem like we're at maybe a stage historically where Protestants and Catholics can speak to one another maybe more temperately than we have in the past. I don't know if I'm phrasing that correctly.
We're not killing each other anymore for the most part, and that's always a good thing.
Wait, is that always a good thing when Christians are not killing
for
one another?
For the most part, yeah.
For general, you'd say yeah.
Yeah. Also, there's, just because someone has a different – because coming from a different perspective doesn't mean that we can't learn something from them. All truth is God's truth.
Yeah.
And St. Thomas Aquinas was a great exponent of this. I mean, he would read in his age, the writings of Aristotle were coming back into circulation and being publicized. And he would, even though some people or in his age were kind of hinky about this, he would say, no, all truth is God's truth. If Aristotle has some things to say that are true, then we can incorporate those into a Christian framework. Well, that's true even with a pagan like Aristotle. It's also true of fellow Christians who just don't happen to be Catholic. So there are things where a Luther or an Edwards or a Protestant Bible scholar or a Jewish Bible scholar or an Orthodox Bible scholar, if someone's got a valuable insight, then it's God's truth, and we can prudently, like St. Thomas Aquinas did, use and incorporate that insight in a Catholic context.
Right, and Aquinas was so systematic, he didn't tend to be emotional about it. He'd work through the issue, not, this guy's a jerk.
Right, the question is truth, not tribe.
Well put. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884. Our number, give us a call if you've got a question about the Catholic faith.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
The Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Abortion, the most important issue on the face of the earth, and perhaps the most difficult to discuss. We're afraid it's impolite, or we'll be branded a fanatic, or we'll get tongue-tied. Trent Horn has written a book that could become the go-to resource for anyone wishing to convey the pro-life message. Persuasive Pro-Life from Catholic Answers cuts through the fog of the pro-choice side with real-life examples of how to dialogue about abortion. Order at 888-291-8000, Catholic.com, or your Catholic bookstore.
Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Very happy to be back here in the studio after a couple days sick. Thanks to Don Johnson and Chris Check, who filled in while I was away. I don't like it when Don Johnson fills in. It makes me nervous because he does a good job.
The guy from Miami Vice?
But, no, not the other Don Johnson, the Catholic Radio Don Johnson.
Okay.
I'm always wary of Don because he does such a fine job. With Chris Check, I don't worry because I know that he's the president.
He has other things he's doing.
Yeah, he's too busy. I do want to remind people.
We love you, Si. Don't worry about it.
Oh, thank goodness, Jimmy. Thank you very much for saying that. Both Don and Chris pointed this out. I want to point it out myself. January is Sanctity of Life Month. There'll be marches for life happening all over the country, maybe here in San Diego. I got to find out. It seems to be an every other year thing here in San Diego, but I'll find out. And so for the month of January, Catholic Answers is making Trent Horn's book, Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue, and his DVD, Making the Case for Life, each available for only $5. That's a savings of over 70%. They still have that $5 flat rate shipping thing going. So just go to Catholic.com or call 888-291-8000 if you would like to get your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life, How to Talk About Our Culture's Toughest Issue, or the DVD, Making the Case for Life, both from Trent Horn for $5 each. Again, shop.catholic.com is the place to go online. Jimmy, I'm monitoring Facebook closely today.
Okay.
And I'm going to Amponsa. Sorry, it took me a second to get – I want to make sure I got the pronunciation right. Amponsa asks this, please. This issue of Jesus' existence, are there any records of contemporary history that support his historical existence apart from the one given by Josephus? Because Josephus' case is only after the death of Jesus, and Josephus was even born years after the death of Jesus. Please, any explanation, I dearly appeal. So what about the historical sources?
Okay, so, there are the Gospels, and one of them for sure was written by an eyewitness. Mm-hmm. I mean, John's Gospel is very frank about the fact it was written by an eyewitness. Now, it was written after his death and resurrection and ascension, but it's eyewitness testimony. Mm-hmm. So just because it's coming from a Christian perspective doesn't mean you write it off. I mean, if you had, let's say a partisan of Abraham Lincoln,
yeah,
after he was assassinated, write a biography of Abraham Lincoln. You don't write it off and say, oh, Abraham Lincoln never existed. This guy, you know, is made some Union sympathizer. We don't listen to anything he has to say.
Right.
You know, that's ridiculous. No historian proceeds that way.
Right.
And so actually the Gospels, even though it, at least one, and I would argue two with Matthew, were written by eyewitnesses, even with Mark and Luke, who are kind of second-generation authors, they're relying on eyewitness testimony. Mark is based on Peter's eyewitness testimony and the eyewitness testimony of some other people, and so is Luke. And if you want to read about that, there's a really great book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by a British author named Richard Baucom, B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M, Richard Baucom. Really good. They just came out, incidentally, with a new edition of Jesus and the Eyewitnesses that has like three extra chapters, and I've read them and they're really great. So highly recommend that book. So I would say we've got really good historical evidence, and not just in the form of the Gospels. I mean, St. Paul.
Yeah.
Is writing. He's going around founding churches, talking to people about Jesus. This didn't come out of nowhere,
yeah.
You know. And I've written before, and now what we would not expect to survive are like census records and things like that from Jesus's time when he was alive, or arrest records or things like that, because we don't have that for anybody from this period. The records have they would make copies of these things, but they didn't make enough copies to survive the ages, because what would happen, especially in parts of the world that are humid, like most of the world, the writing materials they had would deteriorate with age. And so that's why we find like caches of documents in the desert in Egypt where it's dry,
yeah.
But we don't find big caches of papyrus documents or parchment documents in the Greek islands where it's wet. And so typically, the only writings we find in those places are – or Israel would be like clay and stone and metal artifacts. But that's not what they wrote arrest records and birth certificates on.
Yeah. Right.
And so as a result, the records that would have been kept at the time have all perished. We wouldn't expect to have them for Jesus, just like we don't have them for other people. We know about other people, say, who were executed by the Roman state. But we don't have their arrest records in the Roman archives. We don't have their birth certificates, but right. we know they existed because historical sources talk about them after they had been executed, after they'd become famous and done something worth executing them over. So if you just apply the same historical tests to Jesus's case that you would to any of these others, it's abundantly clear that he existed. I've written about this before. I'm trying to think what some good search terms would be. It's on my website, jimmyakin.com. But if you go there and you use the search field and type in Jesus exists, or even if you just Google Jesus exists, Jimmy Akin, you'll come up with some stuff I've written where I take a kind of indirect approach rather than relying exclusively on documents that that talk about Jesus. I talk about the growth of the church, and I document how the church grew really rapidly. And just within the space of a few decades, it went to nothing to all over the Greco-Roman world.
Yeah.
And the only way that happens in an age before the internets and before mass communication and before travel of the kind we have today is if you really make an effort to spread the faith. And that requires organization.
Mm-hmm.
So where did the early Christian movement get its organization? Who is it led by? How did it get organized? What did the Christians have to say for themselves? And you can construct an argument just based on the growth of the church that points to the existence of a charismatic founder for this organization that gave it this missionary impulse to go out and do this really hard thing of spreading itself all over the world before mass communication and mass transit. And when you realize it, the evidence points to some original charismatic founder who had a missionary drive that he gave the church, then there's just no reason not to take the early Christian leaders at their word that his name happened to be Jesus.
Anne Ponsat, thanks very much for that question. I always find it, Jimmy, the argument that, well, Jesus is not a clearly established historical figure, or even the argument that people will go so far as to say there never was a Jesus, to be among the weakest and least reasonable of the anti-Jesus arguments.
Oh, yeah. It even among scholars, biblical scholars who have no Christian faith whatsoever, who are atheists, I mean, there's virtually no traction for the Jesus mythicist movement. I mean, there are a few people here and there that claim this,
right,
but not scholars of standing, and there's virtually no traction about this. If someone wants to read more about that, there's a Protestant scholar named Larry Hurtado, H-U-R-T-A-D-O, and he has a blog. So if you Google Larry Hurtado, he's a really good scholar of early Christianity. And he's lately on his blog been kind of jousting with some Jesus mythicist people. And
okay,
so you might want to check him out.
Larry Hurtado.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. 888-318-7884, the number. It is open forum today. So if you've got a question that's been bugging you about the Catholic Church, why do Catholics believe that? Why do Catholics do that? Give us a call, 888-318-7884. We'll do our very best to clear it up. Jimmy Akin is our guest. He's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And also, you said jimmyakin.com is the place where you can find his writing all over the place, all over the internets. I like the plural, the internets.
Or the interwebs.
The interwebs. Let's go now to a caller, Misty in Bloomfield, Indiana, listening on the TuneIn app. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Misty, your question.
Hi, guys. First of all, happy early 20th to you.
Oh, you're the first. Thank you.
Indeed, and glad to see you back, Si. Actually, before I get to my question, if I may very briefly be permitted to respond to an earlier caller.
Actually, we really don't do that because we can't screen what you're saying,
okay,
and
I'll
then
do that.
It might put me in the position of having to politely correct you in front of tens of thousands of people.
Okay.
So we try
to
avoid that.
Okay, I'm sorry. All right, so my question is, and I think, Jimmy, you have done a podcast on this, if I'm correct. My question is, if our first parents were originally vegetarian in the Garden of Eden, even though God later allowed us to consume meat, obviously after the fall, after the Noahic flood, is being a vegetarian actually the ideal state of diet for the Christian, or is there really no difference, and why or why not?
Okay, so this question can be answered along a couple of lines. The first one is the New Testament is really clear about the fact that Jesus declared all foods clean. Mark chapter 7, all foods are clean. They can all be eaten. They can all be received with thanksgiving. In Acts chapter 10, in a vision, God tells Peter not to call anything that he has created unclean. Paul talks about the fact that God made all these things for us to receive them with thanksgiving. So there is no ideal in terms of religious reasons today. Now, is there an ideal in terms of health reasons? Sure. Our bodies operate better with certain combinations of macronutrients and micronutrients than others. Different people have different dietary needs. They have different health conditions that may need different things. And so there's a lot of variability in terms of what it's good for us to consume. And it's not the same for every person, and it's not the same for every person at every moment in their lives. When it comes to what's the ideal diet in that sense, the church would defer to science and say this isn't a religious matter, it's a health matter, and that puts it in the domain of science. So once we eventually develop good dietary science, which we really haven't done yet, that's what you'd want to look to help tell you what the ideal diet for you at this moment in your life will be. Having said that, since you raised it in terms of vegetarianism, there are people who think vegetarianism is somehow ideal for us today, but there are counterarguments to that which are quite significant. In fact, if you want to lead an all-vegetarian lifestyle, it's possible, but there are certain nutrients that we get from meat that are very hard to get from exclusively plant sources. And so that's a pointer that a purely vegetarian diet, unless you take special precautions and really are careful about where you're getting certain nutrients, is probably not the ideal for most people in most situations. But again, that's going to be a matter of science. That's not a matter of religion. In terms of what do we do with the biblical text in Genesis, this portion of Genesis, both the portion where God gives Adam and Eve the right to eat of the different fruits in the Garden of Eden except for the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and later at the flood where he gives Noah and his family the right to eat meat as well. These are within the primordial history in Genesis, Genesis 1 through 11. And scholars have long recognized that the genre in this part of Genesis is not history in the sense that later portions of Genesis and the other books of the Old Testament are. This is something, for example, Pope Pius XII talked about in his encyclical Divino Afflante Spiritu, that it's not history in the same way as history later came to be written. It has historical elements, but they're presented in a way that's different. And that means we have to raise a question about to what extent should we press the details of when the permissions to give different foods are given to mankind. One of the things you note when you read this early portion of Genesis is that Adam is made the gardener of Eden, and he's then allowed to eat the fruits of the garden. So he's allowed to benefit from his labor. And then Noah, at the time of the flood, is entrusted with caring for all of the animal life. And then as a result of that, he's given the right to eat the fruit of his labor. He's allowed to eat meat. And so we have to ask a question, does this really mean that humans were originally vegetarian? Well, that's not suggested by the archaeological record, which indicates that we've been meat eaters for as long as we've been here. Maybe Genesis is just making the broader point that whatever job you have, whatever task God has given you to do in this life, you have the right to benefit from the result of your labor. If you're a farmer, you get to eat the plants you cultivate. If you're a gamekeeper, you get to eat the animals you cultivate. Man has a right from God to benefit from the labor that God has given him.
Misty, we got to take a break, so I will have to say thank you for that call. We do appreciate it. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Our number, 888-31-TRUTH. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
January is Pro-Life Month, and to get as many people as we can involved in the pro-life cause, we're making Trent Horn's book, Persuasive Pro-Life, available for just $5 a copy. That's a savings of over 70%. This book was made specifically with you in mind, to help you engage in sustained and meaningful dialogue, and to give you the tools you need to change people's hearts and minds, so that together, we might build up a pro-life culture, one person, one conversation at a time. To get your copies of the book Persuasive Pro-Life for just $5 each, call 1-888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com.
Whatever I have learned, writes Catholic Answers founder Carl Keating, I have learned from the masters of the craft. In his new book, Booked for Life, a bibliographic memoir of an accidental apologist, Carl gives future generations a roadmap of what it takes and what it means to become a Catholic apologist. In the way only Carl can, he recounts numerous real-life situations he has encountered in his long career that illustrate the apologetic lessons he's learned. Then, drawing on a lifetime of experience, Carl reveals the books that helped him learn to defend the Catholic faith. Order your copy of Booked for Life today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible? Or did Protestants remove seven books from the Old Testament? In Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger, author Gary Machuda takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information, discourse on crucial issues, and a topical index, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. Order your copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm just so happy to be here. I really missed being here while I was sick. It was very...
We missed you.
Oh, thank you, Jimmy. I really did miss the place. Don does a great job, and Chris Check does a fairly reasonable job. No, he does a great job, but I just I want to be here in front of this microphone. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of many things, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And our topic this hour, whatever is on your mind. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, our Catholic life, what we do, what we avoid, why we do those things, why we avoid them, they're all welcome. 888-318-7884. Haven't had too many folks call who were expressly not Catholic today, so I want to stress to if you're listening and you are not a Catholic, your call is very, very welcome. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Jared in Alabama listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app, Jared. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Speaking about people who are not Catholic, I'm not Catholic.
Welcome.
I'm a Protestant. And, I'm a Protestant. I grew up Baptist, and I've been researching the Catholic and Orthodox faith right now, and trying to decide which one is the church founded by Christ. And one of the things that is kind of ringing as an issue for me is the atonement and how the Catholics understand the atonement. And I've read some Orthodox apologetics talking about basically they advocate for, you know, the Christus Victor position, you know, Jesus, you know, just came to defeat death. Mm-hmm. And so basically the book that I was reading was basically arguing that the Catholics kind of, you know, distorted that and made it, you know, really legalized, I guess you could say. And so I guess I was wondering, you know, how do the Catholics really understand the atonement, and how would you respond to the accusation that the Catholics have just added to the understanding of the atonement by making it just overly legalized?
Well, I would say that anyone who is making claims like that is going to have a hard time documenting them in church teaching, because I've made a special study of the way the atonement is conceptualized in church teaching as opposed to just what individual theologians may say. When you look at what the church actually teaches, it doesn't have a single model for how the atonement works. The atonement is a rich event. It's something that goes beyond our ability to fully comprehend. It's a theological mystery in the true sense. And consequently, the church hasn't said a whole lot on a doctrinal level about how it works. It's told us what some of the effects of it are. We're forgiven, we're sanctified, we experience new life and regeneration. So it's talked about the effects of it. It's talked about how it was accomplished. It was accomplished by Jesus on the cross. But in terms of conceptualizing it beyond that, the church really leaves it open to theologians to explore. And so the Christus Victor model is one that Catholics can use, nobody should get too exclusive about any one particular model, because it is a rich event. It is a mystery that exceeds our ability to fully understand. And so we don't want to get dogmatic about one particular model. But having said that, there's a lot of flexibility here. And the approach that I tend to take is a complementary model where I see value in different respects in multiple different models of the atonement. The one that I think tends to be primary, and this is just my personal opinion, but the one I think tends to be primary is the model of sacrifice, because that's the one we see stressed in the New Testament. We see Christ depicted as our Passover lamb and as our high priest who's also our victim. And there are a bunch of passages in the New Testament that stress that. There are also passages in the New Testament that stress the model of Christ as the victor who triumphs over the powers of darkness and leads them in his train and so forth, which is a kind of reference to the way, for example, the Romans would have captives brought in a procession during a military triumph after a great victory. So you do have that element as well. But based on my study, the New Testament seems to present the sacrifice model as the primary one. But then these other models also play a contributing role in helping flesh out our understanding of the richness of what Christ did for us on the cross.
Jared?
No? Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right.
Yeah, I was just wondering about that. They bring up, you know, different examples like Anselm of Canterbury with the honor theory and things like that and penal substitution. And I just didn't know, you know, how the church taught on those issues.
Yeah. Now, penal substitution is one that's more common in Protestant circles, actually, the idea that God punished Jesus instead of us. Most Catholic scholars have had a problem with that one in particular. It's acknowledged that Jesus did something in which he suffered and that brought benefit to us. But in terms of did God literally punish Jesus when he should have punished us because of our guilt, that's one that Catholics have generally stayed away from. But in terms of what's permitted, there's a wide range of latitude here.
Jared, thanks very much for that call. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, and we're going to do a whole hour after this. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. Don't go anywhere. If you haven't called and you'd like to ask a question about the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884 is the number. Jimmy, before the break, I want to get to a question from Alan here in the studio visiting us from San Francisco. If someone was selling sacraments such as holy orders for personal gain, would these be invalid orders?
No. They would be simoniacal. They'd involve the crime of simony, which is based on a passage in Acts chapter 8 where Simon Magus is trying to buy the power to confer confirmation.
Right.
So they would be simoniacal, but they wouldn't be invalid as a result.
So I guess that this refers in part, Alan, to the time when there was a lot of corruption in the church, in the hierarchy of the church. So people were buying and selling bishoprics,
offices, and
all
things
that kind
like
of thing.
That. Yeah.
So those are crimes to do those things, but that doesn't invalidate them. Someone wants to be a bishop, and another bishop ordains them bishop.
Right. It doesn't stop the sacrament from being valid. What's required for validity is that a sacrament be celebrated with the proper form, the proper matter, and the proper intent. But the intent that's required is the intent to confer the sacrament, the intent to do what the church does.
Right.
Doesn't mean you got to have a pure heart when you're doing it.
Right,
if
right,
you did, then any time a priest or anybody was not in a state of grace, they couldn't confer a sacrament, and that would result in disaster. So we know that
we'd never know if we had received
you'd never
a
know.
Sacrament.
So you can be in a state of sin and still confer or receive a sacrament validly.
Alan, thanks for visiting us from San Francisco. If you're out there and you'd like to visit, we're here in El Cajon, and we love to have visitors while we're doing the show. Jimmy Akin is our guest next hour. You're really going to like this Jimmy Akin guy. We'll bring him in here. We'll do a whole...
I've heard about him.
Yeah,
I
hope
bit.
You've heard good things.
A little bit.
And it is open forum for another hour. So if you've got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you are Catholic or not, give us a call, 888-318-7884. We'll do our very best to get to your question when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.